Good morning, Prince George. This is Uncle Don beaming out to the charming city of Prince George from the nearly vacant campus of UNBC. Everyone with any sense is off and away for the holidays, leaving me, the volunteers at CFUR, a number of board security types, and the odd moose alone on this beautiful campus. This is a special New Year's Eve show to kick off a day of holiday programming here at CFUR. Stay tuned for great listening all day and into the night. As for now, this is Uncle Don with a cheerful edition of Uncle Don Reads the Comics. This edition of Uncle Don Reads the Comics is dedicated to the first openly fascist elected dictator in the United States of America. George Bush the Lesser began by stealing or buying degrees from American universities, went on to rob investors in a major jock corporation, and then an oil company or two. With these scams for practice, he ripped off a presidential election and went on to steal the entire American government. Now he is above the Constitution and Bill of Rights so he can rule by edict. Under Bush the Younger, the United States joined such forerunners in elected dictatorships like Nazi Germany, Berlusconi's Italy, Putin's Russia, and a whole fleet of minor terrorized states in Latin America and Africa. Good on you, George. Now that security's been tightened on the American border, there have been questions raised about Santa's ability to slip through American air defenses. I don't doubt the official denials, but I had some misgivings when I saw the item on eBay by a person in Washington State who was selling a large red sleigh and 8 reindeer. If you like what you hear from Uncle Don, write to CFUR Radio. If you don't like what you hear from Uncle Don, write to CFUR Radio at 3333 University Way, Prince George, B.C., V2N4Z9. Your vote will be worth as much as a vote against the aforementioned son of a Bush. At this very moment around the globe, pregnant women are asking doctors and midwives to speed up or slow down their labors in hopes of being the first in their time zone to deliver a New Year's baby. Never having gone through labor myself, I'm no authority on the subject, but from what I hear, it is a process that no one would want to prolong needlessly nor shorten at the risk of causing complications. The first infant to see the light tomorrow will be showered with diapers, scholarships, McDonald's coupons, yuck, and subscriptions to the National Enquirer. Why? Tradition. Who cares? But Uncle Don does notice that there is an increasing trend these days to name children after past hurricanes. There's no accounting for what parenthood does to some people's heads. I've come up with a list of resolutions for the new year, but my wife says she will not adhere to them, just like her. Since I cannot think of any ways to improve my own actions, I will fall back on the old favorite of making predictions for the coming year. I predict that the sun will continue to rise in the east and set in the west. This is not a sure thing, according to one of my faithful listeners. He tells me that the earth is due to switch its poles in reverse direction of spin. This would cause certain disruptions, such as having the Pacific Ocean slosh across Canada. If the listener is correct, expect to see the Lions Gate Bridge in PEI one day. But that would be the least of our worries. I predict that George Bush Jr. will find an excuse to attack Iraq. That's more probable than my first prediction. There's no letting up for this monomaniac, who is not a moron, as he is a friend of Jean Chrétien's. I predict that Gordon Campbell will continue to destroy the province of British Columbia. Easy one. Services will continue to be cut and assets sold off to friends. Watch for selling off at bargain prices of BC Hydro, ICBC, some roads, and BC Ferries. Maybe the BC Buildings Corporation will also go with all these valuable real estate that they hold in trust for us. We can then pay corporations to rent what used to belong to us. I predict that someone will attack Campbell and or one of his ministers. This will give this government the excuse to tighten security and public access to liberal politicians. Being surrounded by goons will make Campbell feel more like his idol, Ronald Reagan. I predict that tuition at UNBC and CNC will be raised by a large percentage. Something must be done to clear the campus of impoverished young people and make more room for the children of the upper classes. I predict that the administrations of these institutions will increase the number of foreign students who could be milked for higher tuition and fees. Not that I have any objection to having foreign students. Exposure to people of different nationalities and cultures can be a valuable component of tertiary education. I do not believe that foreign students should be admitted at the expense of squeezing our own citizens out of the opportunity for higher education. I predict that our government will continue to follow the U.S. lead in spying on its citizens and compiling files on all of us. Already a school board was caught with a secret camera installed in a counselor's office. Wireless technology allows digital spy cameras to be placed anywhere, and the crystal clear images are then available to be transmitted over the internet. The U.S. is compiling dossiers on almost all of its citizens. Here in Canada, the Privacy Commissioner has futilely objected to the government's retaining information on all air travelers. They will supposedly keep these records for 6 years so they can compile a profile of where you go, how you pay, where you stay, and where you order whether you order a special meal on the flight. Big Brother is in. I predict that Uncle Don will continue to broadcast on CFUR for the coming year unless I draw too much attention from the ruling class. The Liberal government of BC continues to attack its critics. Now they've made a public attack on the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, a think tank that has a left slant. The CCPA has been smeared by the so-called Canadian Taxpayers Federation, a front group for the rich, and the BC government, which at present is another front group for the rich. The previous provincial NDP government gave a grant to the CCPA to fund a 5-year study on income inequality. This grant at $40,000 per year is chicken feed considering the way this current government is throwing money at its friends. But the main issue here is that this government does not want to hear anything about income inequality, much less have a study done on its specifics. They're trying to cancel the grant and they want their money back. The Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives is one of the few research organizations that provide a balance of perspective to the well-heeled Fraser Institute, the C.D. Howe Institute, and a great number of right-wing organizations across our southern border. Both the Howe and Fraser Institutes claim that they do not accept government money, but they hide behind their tax-exempt status to operate with our tax money. The tax deduction is very valuable to their supporters, who are mostly corporations and rich individuals. The CCPA performs economic and social research without ties to any party. It's been deeply critical of the NDP when it attacked our social programs. Now it is critical of the Liberals. If you want to see an example of their work, check out the file of the CCPA Monitor, a monthly bulletin, at the Prince George Perg on the UNBC campus. If you have a right-wing bias, you will not like it, but you will have to admit that it is well done and their research is valid. Now I would like the CCPA to do a thorough study of the funding of the so-called Canadian Taxpayers Federation. That would be interesting. I think that this secret outfit would turn out to be a hollow front for right-wing nuts. Coincidentally, the CCPA has just come out with a report on inequality. The Globe and Mail reported that this under the heading, Gap Between Rich and Poor Widening, study concludes. Is anyone surprised? Canada has historically had less of a poverty problem than the states, as we have taxed the rich and infused the money into the pockets of the poorer members of our society. Now that difference is dissolving, and we are becoming like the states with more desperately poor people. But there is a balance, so all is well. The study concludes that the average fortunes of the top 10% of the population has doubled over the past 3 decades. Let us give thanks for the rich who cast us the crumbs from their tables. I have the latitude on these programs to say almost anything. I have to be careful to opening myself and the station to charges of slander, so I temper my attacks on local thieves. George Bush and Gordon Campbell are good targets, and they don't give a damn what I say here in Prince George. John Major, our exalted gambling czar, is another kettle of fish. I can advocate armed revolution. I can support Osama bin Laden. I have almost unlimited latitude, as long as I don't use the F word. That would violate community standards, as perceived by the CRTC. Burning down the university does not violate these standards, but there is an army of little old ladies huddled by their radios right now waiting for me to drop the F word so they can write irate letters on scented stationery to the CRTC. It is a strange world. The United States Army would be rendered mute if the F word were banned. In military discourse, that F-word and its various permutations, particularly when coupled with a word for the female parent, has evolved from a verb to a noun, adjective, adverb, conjunction, and every other part of speech short of an article. Sifting the F-words from a conversation would leave a very short exchange. Not that this is a purely working-class term. Remember President Nixon and his expletive deleteds on his tapes? Recall Pierre Trudeau's comment in the Parliament, fuddle-duddle, as it came out in Hansard. I can cuss with the best of them, but I can control myself. How? Simple. I write a script and then use the auto-replace function to delete all the F-words, thus shortening the piece by a couple of pages. Thank goodness for Bill Gates and his inventions. Contrary to popular belief, I do not hate Christmas. To me, this is just another holiday that was hijacked by the medieval Christian church and adopted as its own. To me, the main event of the season is the solstice, the shortest day of the year, heralding the imminent return of the sun and mosquitoes. The church plugged some improbable saints into the pagan celebrations, and it became theirs. I feel that I am in the forefront of reclaiming the holiday from the superstitious. Long ago, I escaped from the madness of gift buying for an extended family. Gradually, a truce was called in buying one another unwanted junk to fill the next summer's garage sales. We exchange cards and letters with friends and dispatch pouches of white powder to those who inflict on us breathless photocopied descriptions of their amazing adventures of the past year and the accomplishment of their precocious children. There have been a few hangers-on to the gift list. One was a widow of a man I worked for in California. Every year, she sent a delicious fruitcake. In a land of mediocre cakes of this ilk, these were really good, and every year I agonized over what to send her in exchange. I scoured the stores for unique Canadian gifts and then bought her a slab of smoked salmon, every year, including this one. But a few days ago I received a Christmas card from her daughter telling me that her mother died last February. I hope she enjoys the surprise salmon, the end of an era for me. Now my stepdaughter is in Regina, training to be a COP, but she is maintaining a home here with a guy here in Prince George. The guy, who is already a COP, has a 5-year-old daughter who has found her way onto our Christmas list. I was assigned the job of buying a suitable gift for her this year. My wife suggested that I get her a little outfit. This sounded like an odd gift to buy for the daughter of a COP, but what do I know of the mores of today's youth? Kids who get off on Spider-Man, Pokemon, and something or other moon Japanese cartoons leave me far behind. The spoon and candle parts of the outfit I found in our junk drawers. The surgical rubber tube I bought at PG SurgeMed. I had to go to a pharmacy for the eyedropper and syringe. I fervently hope that this little outfit only heralds a stage she is going through and will not lead her into trouble. But what do I know? In California, my circle of friends had a different view of gifts. Over assorted drinks and smokes, we developed a game that we played with things. We called this unloading. The object of the game was to con someone into saying something favorable about one of your possessions. A person carelessly passing a compliment found him or herself the owner of said object. We rapidly came to an understanding this did not apply to cash, negotiable instruments, automotive vehicles, or sexual partners. Beyond these exceptions, the sky was pretty much the limit. This led us to be very emphatic in denouncing the beauty or utility of any object. The standard answer to a question of, "What do you think of this?" was, "It's a piece of shit." As soon as that was established, it was safe to be frank. One day at a party, I saw one of the women drop her guard and say that the dress of another looked nice. Within the minute, the admirer was speechlessly holding the garment, leaving her friend in her underwear. Another evening, I was visiting friends who were accomplished wine drinkers. They bought their plunk and gallon jugs, and we were involved in draining one of these when talk turned to the utility of the empties. We speculated as to how they could be cut in two and used for planters, how they could be used floats for fish nets, and all manner of other blue-sky thinking. I was asked if I thought they would be useful. The wine in me said yes, and my erstwhile friends sprang into action. Before I realized what had happened, they had taken their entire stash of jugs and loaded them into my car, filling the back seat and passenger seat. According to the rules of the unload, I could not dump them somewhere, but I was obliged to con someone else into accepting them. I forget how I finally found a home for these jugs, but it was not easy. The system of unloading was fun for those of us who played the game, and it had definite subversive potential. Picture a suburban neighborhood in a dismal place, like College Heights. 100 dismally identical houses, sheathed in plastic, each with a lawnmower. Just suppose that these 100 neighbors embraced the version of the unloading philosophy. Would there be 100 lawnmowers? No. If I could admire a neighbor's lawnmower when my lawn grew shaggy, I would not need to hoard my own machine. I could rely on another neighbor then to admire that lawnmower away from me, so I would not need to keep my garage full of toys and tools all year. As long as people contributed to the maintenance of the tools that they had when they had them, this could benefit everyone. Unfortunately, this would require a level of responsibility on the part of citizens that we do not see in today's world. The Cuban revolutionaries tried to mold a new citizen who would share in the work, responsibilities, and benefits of joint ownership. It has worked to a degree, but there are still enough who do not share the ideal to screw the system up. It seems that we have not evolved enough as a species to overcome an animal selfishness that undermines our joint endeavors. Christmas time is not fun for everyone. This is the busiest time of year for crisis centers. Domestic violence is up and there is depression abroad in the land. Why? Christmas time is when we are surrounded with exhortations to buy, buy, buy. There are scenes everywhere of happy families sharing the joy of the season. Anyone who is isolated or cannot join in the feeding frenzy of shopping is made to feel like a failure, and there are relatively few who can indulge in all of their desires to buy all of that junk. Imagine yourself at this time of year as a street person in Prince George, or perhaps a single mother trying to make a pittance from welfare or part-time minimum wage paycheck cover necessities until the end of the month. You would be surrounded with Santas and screaming ads touting the great and expensive toys for adults and children. It would be a depressing time. Can you picture what Christmas is like in jail? The guards are going home to their families at night. They're talking about Christmas preparations and exchanging greetings. What do the prisoners have to look forward to? A week or so with no work programs and endless television, which will keep rubbing their noses in the supposed joys of the season. They will be thinking of their families struggling through the season without them. And most will be struggling, as rich people don't, as a rule, go to jail. I spent 3 Christmases in the Army, wasting time in the barracks and other bored and frustrated soldiers, waiting for the whole thing to be over so we could resume our numbing routines. There was too much alcohol and too little to do. My toes curl when I recall the Christmas Eve when an Army truck loaded with kids of soldiers who lived on the base with their families came around and we were treated to Christmas carols. They were booed. We did not want to have our noses rubbed in the joy that others felt at that time. If you are alone or broken this season, it may be some consolation that you share the fate of many of our fellow citizens. With the massive layoffs and cutbacks in services that people used to have to cushion adversity, there are a lot of desperate people out there. But it may be some consolation to realize that 20% of those tax cuts that our provincial government made our provincial government so poor went to give the richest 1% of our citizens a jolly Christmas. If you are in that 1%, perhaps Campbell bought you a nice new BMW. May you wrap it around a tree and end up a victim of our strangled medical system. Merry Christmas. We've now passed the 15-month mark on the War on Terror. Time for a bit of a wrap-up. Where are we? We have enough perspective after this time that I can feel the pattern of events. The first target of the Bush assault was Osama bin Laden. Remember him? He supposedly engineered the September attacks, and all was focused on him. I recall the early weeks of the so-called war when the regime trumpeted that they were 48 hours away from killing or capturing bin Laden. That prediction disappeared down the memory hole. Now bin Laden has been almost forgotten. As Afghanistan was pulverized and the Taliban regime collapsed, it was determined that they were the target. They may not have been directly responsible for the attacks, but they were harboring terrorists, including bin Laden. Besides, they oppressed women and were drug traffickers, an interesting sideline that tied the war on terror into the war on drugs. It was only later that we were told that the Taliban had almost eradicated the growing of opium poppies in Afghanistan. When the smoke cleared, literally, we found a destroyed country beyond the city limits of Kabul entirely run by warlords. What did they do? They continued to oppress women and they reignited the drug trade. Opium is again a big cash crop in Afghanistan, and there is no longer a real central government to do anything about it. While the United States leaves its allies to clean up the mess in Afghanistan, Bush has gone on to bigger game. Now we find that Iraq is a center of terror and that it is suspected of having ties to terrorists, a vague charge that requires no substantiation. This charge holds no water since the Al-Qaeda is adamantly opposed to non-Islamic governments in the Middle East. It's ridiculous to believe that they would support or take support from Iraq. Very recently, Bush Light's White House issued a document they called the National Strategy to Combat Weapons of Mass Destruction. Therein, they threatened any aggressor with nuclear attack. So much for past pledges of no first strike use of such awesome weapons. Nuclear weapons of any sort, no matter how they are sold to the American public, do not represent a simple increase in firepower. The use of any nuclear device will push the world across a threshold into an unknown chain of events. We don't know, the Bush regime does not know, all of the many think tanks do not know what would follow a nuclear attack on anyone. The American government claims that they have proof that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. They have photos. They have secret evidence. Of course, the evidence is so secret that they will not tell the weapons inspectors that the UN has sent to find these weapons of mass destruction. That would be tattling. Hans Blix has come out and told the United States to put up or shut up. The charges that the Bush regime is throwing at Iraq now have a mirror image. Take any one of them, substitute the United States for Iraq and Bush for Hussein, and they ring true. Weapons of mass destruction? Who has the largest stockpile? Oppresses his own people. Who has 2 million in prisons? Has used chemical weapons. What was napalm in Vietnam? Flaunting of Security Council resolutions? Who's intent on attacking whom regardless of the will of the United Nations? Another Hitler? You figure it out. When Bush gets the war he wants, there's no doubt that the United States can win. There are merely differences of opinion as to how long it will take and how messy it will be. No one knows. It could end quickly with an internal overthrow of Saddam Hussein and a quick capitulation. Or, in the worst possible case, it could be a war of attrition in the cities that would make the massacre on Jenin look tiny. The big question is what will happen to post-war Iraq. It may fall apart, as did Afghanistan, with regional heavies grabbing what territory they can. Hussein's power seems to be the glue that holds Iraq together, and without his power, all bets are off. Iraq is a relatively new country, carved out of the wreckage of the Ottoman Empire in 1920. It was created as a kingdom, and monarchs have held it together. Bush Light talks as though he can parachute a democracy into the wreckage of war and create an elected dictatorship on the Canadian model that will be a sedate member of the family of nations. Don't hold your breath, George. Tain't gonna happen. All of the foregoing assumes that this will just be a war between Iraq and the United States, that is, the U.S. and whatever bootlickers it can bribe or coerce into joining in. There will, of course, be Tony Blair in Britain, who has finally completed the transition of Britain from the empire with the American colony to a colony of the American empire. Congratulations, Tony. And there is our own Jean Chrétien, who has already sent our ships to the Persian Gulf to play pirates for the Yanks. It seems that we have also lost a self-respect in pursuit of the favor of our powerful neighbors. A separate issue is the transformation of the United States itself in the last year and a quarter. No longer a nation of self-confident individuals, it had become a paranoid land that lives in constant fear of attack from mysterious terrorists. Forget the fact that fewer than 3,000 Americans have died altogether in 15 months of so-called war. This is just 200 a month, which sounds like a Saturday night in Chicago. So they have to be so afraid of these terrorists beneath the bed that they throw their Bill of Rights, their freedoms, and their privacy out the window? Now they have arbitrary detentions, secret hearings, and all manner of privacy invasions, all in the name of fighting those who would impose on the world regimes that use arbitrary detentions, secret hearings, and privacy invasions to control citizens. Not that I give a royal damn what the Americans do to themselves, really. I care that Canada has followed in their footsteps, although the only Canadians to die so far were the ones in New York who had skipped the country for a bigger dollar, and four unfortunates killed by American jet jockeys. If we are not supporting the American imperialism around the world, we would be back in the enviable position of having no enemies. Remember those days? My wife's aunt in Rochester, New York, sends us clippings from her local newspaper. The Rochester Democrat and Chronicle makes the Prince George Citizen look like the Globe and Mail. It is full of misinformation and plain propaganda. A recent column referred to the unfortunate Quebecer who, they said, crossed the American border and was arrested while hunting moose. There is no excuse for their not knowing that he had crossed to buy gasoline in a manner done by residents of this town for many years, with the written consent of American officials. By trivializing this assault on a Canadian's rights, this washed away any blame for the Americans' arrogance and stupidity. Another item prompted me to write an email to the author. My email, after a couple of weeks, has gone unanswered. The article is entitled, "Canada Staunchly Anti-American." Jesus, don't I wish. The author claims that a current issue of the National Review carried an article of his which argued that Canada should be bombed, and that this made him the most reviled American in Canada. Horseshit. The most reviled American in Canada is Bush Light by a long shot, and no one here but hardline, right-winger nutcases pay any attention to the droppings in the National Review, a magazine of the same ilk as BC Report. In his article, he says that Canadian anti-Americanism is just reflexive and without basis. He's angered that Canadians believe that the United Nations has more moral authority than the United States of bloody America. Of all the nerve! Everyone in the world knows that the U.S. is the apex of morality on our planet. My reply follows. 2. Jonah Goldberg. I'm writing in response to your piece entitled Canada Staunchly Anti-American in the 1411 Democrat and Chronicle. A relative in Rochester just sent it to me. I would not agree that you are one of the most reviled Americans north of the 49th parallel, as you state in your column. In fact, few people up here read the National Review or even know of it. We have our own extreme right-wing periodicals to feed Canadians of that bent, thank you. We do revile George Bush Jr. and his cabinet of extremist refugees from the administrations of his father and Ronald Reagan. We reject the United States of America and its self-appointed role as the world's supreme leader. The relative who sent this clipping once said on the telephone, "I wish we didn't have to be the world's policeman." Well, was my reply, "Who asked you?" If the United Nations, imperfect as it is, will not be the moral guide for the world, is the United States in any position to impose its standards on the planet? I think not. We do not see an equivalence between moral supremacy and military supremacy. This comes too close to saying that might makes right, a childish concept. For the past 15 months, you've thrown your economic and military might around pursuing your phony war on terrorism. If you are really opposed to terrorism, look to the allies you have supported in dictatorships around the world. You might start looking in Israel. Look at the terrorist policies you have pursued. The hatred and desperation that your policies have engendered were the fertile ground in which retail terrorism has grown. You've played the sympathy card of the World Trade Center destruction to the point where it is threadbare. Fewer than 3,000 people, many of whom were not Americans, died in that stunt, and you used that as an excuse to brutally slaughter more than that number of innocent Afghans. Maybe one reason that your government is reviled is that you seem to honestly believe that American lives are more important and significant than those of people in other lands. Now your leaders are beating the drum to attack and kill Iraqis in pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, you boast that you sit on the world's largest stockpile of these horrendous weapons. By what moral authority can you possess such weapons while Iraq cannot? I visited Nicaragua in 1986, and I saw the damage that America's mercenaries did in that struggling country. I used to live near Chorrillo, the poor slum in Panama City that Americans destroyed in the invasion to capture Manuel Noriega. I visited Cuba 6 times, and I've seen how that country has struggled to develop in its own way in the face of American attack, sabotage, and blockade. I've traveled in some of the nasty dictatorships that America has supported or created. No, I have no use for America's foreign policies. If you want to dismantle your social structure and create a ruling class that is obscenely rich with a huge lower class of desperately poor, that's your business. When you try to muscle Canada into following your model, it's my business. You're obsessed with marijuana while you don't see handguns as a problem. You export your lethal toys north and say that's our problem. If we send some harmless weed south, you go ballistic. Perhaps you don't see this as a problem, as America is always right and you have God on your side. That card's a bit tattered, too. I do not dislike Americans as individuals. I was born American. I was educated there. I have friends and relatives there. But I have no use for the governments they elected, or which were installed against their will, but that's another matter. I dislike the extreme militarism and domestic repression that these governments have fostered. I came north during the Vietnam War, driven by the extreme revulsion at the slaughter that my country was engaged in. I became a Canadian citizen in 1978, and I've not looked back since. I will not cross your precious border, as you have evidenced no respect for the human rights of foreigners, much less your own citizens. Incidentally, my first visit to Cuba was on a U.S. Navy troop ship. My residence in the Republic of Panama was as a soldier stationed in the Canal Zone. While I was a soldier, I worked in the Ordnance Corps. One of our missions was to supply military-to-military aid to various countries in South and Central America, many of which countries were later taken over by dictators among those we supplied and trained in the Canal Zone at the School of the Americas. I did not know what I was doing at that time, but I have nothing but shame for the part I played in this travesty. I am not waving the Canadian flag. We have few patriots here on the American model. My chosen country is not without flaws, and our current regime is a shameless bootlicker of the United States in its pursuit of small economic advantages. Prime Minister Brian Mulroney proved that the United States was one of the few countries in the world with both a president and a prime minister. He was a traitor and now lives in luxury on the spoils of his economic treachery. Do you disagree with that? Well, try looking at the world once from our point of view. But I doubt if you are able to do that. Your patriotism blinds you and makes you look ridiculous from beyond your borders. But then, you are aiming your columns at a domestic audience that is hopelessly self-absorbed, awash in propaganda of television, and convinced that the United States is the greatest country on earth. Why should you give a damn what a Canadian thinks? Why should any American care what Canadians think? We are, after all, here to provide you with natural resources and markets for your goods, and the economy is the reason you have a society. Perhaps the difference between Americans and most other people in the world is that many of us on the outside of the USA believe that the economy is a servant of society, not the other way around. That's it for Uncle Don Reads the Comic Special Edition for New Year's Eve. This is Uncle Don broadcasting on CFUR 88.7 in Prince George. Right. Stay tuned for special programming for the rest of the day. Celebrate. If you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. Happy New War!